Hi, I'm Deborah Lindad, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world and live toxic free. It is Thursday, August 6th, 2015, and apparently we just had some technical difficulties with my microphone, but I think you can hear me now. And we're going to be talking about something a little bit different today. Usually we talk about toxic chemicals, or we talk about products that don't have toxic chemicals. We talk about detox, all kinds of things like that. But today, for the first time, we're going to be talking to an investigative reporter who we've never talked to an investigative reporter before, but I was very interested to talk to him. I've never even done this before either, which is I called up an investigative reporter after I read a really excellent article last week. When we talked about this article last Wednesday, I talked with Pamela Seafeld, my guest, last Wednesday about this article about the FDA warning dentists that no, if they can possibly help it, no patients of any kind should actually be having mercury fillings. And so today we have the reporter who wrote that story and dug it up and put it all together. And I'm just so excited to talk to him because I want to know all about how investigative reporters investigate and how do they find these stories and what do they do? And, you know, it's such detective work. And I know that for myself, it's like what I do is detective work in a way that it's, you know, finding those hidden toxic chemicals in the consumer products and then finding the products that work better. But this is a real investigative reporter. His name is Greg Gordon. He's a national correspondent for McClatchy Newspaper, Washington Bureau. And he's been an investigative reporter for 38 years, uncovering waste, fraud, abuse, and misconduct in Washington. Hi, Greg.
How are you, Deborah? Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm great. How are you doing?
Pretty well, aside from a little emergency with my son's 8-month-old Siberian Husky who bled all over the floor this morning, probably punctured her digestive tract somehow, and she's in the hospital, and we're already at $1,600 and just getting warmed up.
Uh-huh.
So it's been a stressful morning, but
a little excitement today.
A little excitement. I hope it wasn't a toxin that caused this. I don't think so. I think it was more like eating a branch, probably.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us, how did you become interested in being an investigative reporter?
I guess that traces back to relatively early in my career. My career started at age 5, when my mother says, anyway, that I started putting out a penny newspaper in my neighborhood in a small town in southern Minnesota. Uh-huh. And really kind of shadowed my big brother into journalism because he worked on the student paper, and then so did I, and that continued through college. And in college at the University of Minnesota, which has a very large student paper, the reading population of the University of Minnesota's student paper at the time was like 70 or 80,000. So I was really going to be a sports writer, but I got into digging, and then along came the Vietnam War, and sports just didn't seem very important with what was going on campus. And so I decided that I wanted to try to be a regular news reporter, which was a big transition. And almost immediately, I wanted to dig deeper. Really, when I was a young reporter, wire service reporter in Minneapolis. And really, investigative reporting is one of the definitions for investigative reporting is just finding out information that's concealed from the public. And there's kind of what I call pure investigative reporting, where you're really doing original research, and then there's sort of leak investigative reporting. What did the FBI investigation uncover, and so forth? And I like the original research when I can. Really, I'd call the FDA story that I did sort of a combination of both, but mostly it was trying to. There wasn't an ongoing investigation. I was trying to find out what an agency was doing and why, and I only got part way, frankly. I mean, I think there's more questions to be answered. Just to recap, I mean, the story basically said that after all these decades of defending and allowing the use of what is known in the trade as amalgam fillings. We call them mercury fillings because nobody knows what amalgam is. Mm-hmm. The FDA finally, and really in the face of a lot of people who've come forward and said that when they had the amalgam fillings taken out of their mouths, their health improved in some cases stunningly. For example, some people had symptoms of and were diagnosed as having multiple sclerosis, and it went away. Just went away. I mean, it's astonishing. I mean, most of us probably, certainly older people like me, we know people who have died of multiple sclerosis. In fact, the wife of another journalist for one of the Houston papers just passed away this year that I know, and she suffered horribly of multiple sclerosis. And I'd like to know now how many mercury fillings she had in her mouth. I don't know if that's the sole cause of multiple sclerosis symptoms, but in any event, I think that the FDA's Director of Medical Devices and Radiological Health Division, which oversees and regulates these products, a guy named Jeffrey Schurin, whom I've never met, but my impression is that he sided with whatever faction they had in his unit at the FDA, that he sided with those people in concluding that certain people are sensitive to mercury and vulnerable to significant, potentially disabling, even lethal health effects from mercury, either the vapors or the particles from when they chew gum and break free some of the mercury, because the mercury is bound with other metals, silver mm-hmm. particularly, because that's why we call them silver fillings, or they're often called silver fillings.
Sounds nicer than mercury fillings.
Yeah, exactly, and it's also a selling point. Yeah. You know, the dental profession calls them silver fillings. But anyway, in any event, apparently Jeffrey Schurin sided with these folks. This is my speculation, and got it through of all people. And we had a big decision when we wrote the story about whether to mention that Margaret Hamburg, because there was a ruckus about her. She was the FDA commissioner at the time. She just left this March. Whether Margaret Hamburg had any role in this. And what I was told was no. And so ultimately we took her out of the story. And the reason I raise her is that upon joining the FDA, Margaret Hamburg, also known as Peggy, resigned her position as a member of the board of directors of the Henry Schein Company, which is the biggest distributor of mercury amalgam and a lot of other healthcare products, but in particular the biggest distributor of mercury fillings, the components or the compounds in the United States. And so their stock shot up in 2009 when the FDA decided not to do much of anything about mercury fillings and issued a rule that classified them in class 2, which is not the real dangerous products that where the manufacturers are required to first prove that their product is safe before mm-hmm. it goes on the market. So Hamburg either recused herself, withdrew from any involvement in this, or she said okay. She gave it put her imprimatur on it and sent it on to HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services. To break this down, the FDA, its duty is solely to determine the safety and effectiveness of the products that it regulates. Mm-hmm. The Department of Health and Human Services, they have the responsibility of doing cost-benefit analyses, and this is a process that really traces to the Reagan years, when cost-benefit analyses really became a big deal, and there were a lot of environmental regulatory fights because sometimes, in fact, they would put a value on a human life, and it tended to come down to $1 million at the time. You know, it's okay to spend this much money on exposing this many people to to this toxin or that toxin, but not this much money. There were heated, and there have been really over the last 30, 40 years, some heated arguments about over cost-benefit analyses. So what did HHS do? HHS did a cost-benefit analysis and concluded that lower-income people were going to be harmed by this regulation because it would raise the cost, because the alternative fillings, principally composite fillings, you can also use ceramics or even gold, gold being very expensive, ceramics being more expensive. Composite fillings typically, depends upon the dentist, of course, and the high-end dentists, I'm sure, charge a lot more, but composite fillings typically cost maybe $100 more. So they concluded that low-income people would then just let their teeth decay if the dentist said, look, I don't want to put amalgam in your mouth because it could harm you. And I neglected to mention one of the things that's noted by the FDA is that mercury fillings constantly, continuously release very, very low levels of mercury vapor. And I mentioned chewing gum they found, or if you grind your teeth at night. And I have a few, I'm an older guy, as I said, and so I have a few mercury fillings in my mouth. And I, not to get personal here, but I have to check out a few health issues that I have because they fit into the box of possible problems from exposure to mercury. And, of course, most of us eat fish, and there's mercury in a lot of the fish, especially sushi. Bottom line is the FDA was overruled. And what really was kind of troubling about this is that so the FDA is overruled, and here's this public safety communication that they drafted at the end of 2011. And it had a little date on the top of it, so we've now posted it on our website. It's in a link in the stories, if anybody wants to look. And it says XX12, which is what's the date in 2012 that they're going to issue this public safety communication. And here it is now, 2015. And finally, it comes public, but not through the FDA, but in a newspaper story. It was kept secret for 3 years, and how many people had mercury amalgam implanted without knowing the potential risks in the interim? The American Dental Association would go ballistic to listen to what I just said, because they are as emphatic as you could be in stating that citing what they say is definitive research demonstrating that mercury fillings are perfectly safe. And one of the issues, by the way, is that some people have mercury allergies. And I think that kind of showed up in some of the we published on our website 6 case studies. And I sent some more case studies to some of McClatchy's 29 papers. I did about 10 of them. And a lot of these people had say they had a filling, a mercury filling replaced. They would have an immediate reaction. So here are the dentists, 157,000 member American Dental Association, and the dentists are using these, especially in programs like Medicaid or at the Veterans Administration hospitals or facilities. I don't know how much the VA does on dental, but I think they have some kind of coverage, and places where lower income people would have some sort of insurance coverage that only provides benefits if you use amalgam. And how many of these people didn't get to know over those 3 years, let alone how long this battle inside the FDA has been going on? Because there are pretty clearly factions within the FDA. And Margaret Hamburg's situation was fascinating because when she became the FDA commissioner, it was only about 2 months before the rule that classified mercury fillings as a category two, not a three, not the most worrisome products.
Yeah.
And that's what the consumer lawyers have been fighting this. I didn't mention the consumer lawyers who've been fighting this issue for 23 years, filing suits and challenging rules that are issued and trying to push the FDA towards something more protective of the public. And the dentists are in an interesting position, as I started to say before, because the dentists, some people have mercury allergies. So if the dentist says to the patient when you come in, says, well, I want to put a mercury filling in because it's cheaper and it'll last longer, and they argue, and the other side argues that composites now last just as long. I don't know who's right. But the dentist, are they going to say to the patients, well, I need to give you a test. You know, I need to stick a needle in your arm or whatever. They're going to need to stick some mercury on your skin to see whether you have a mercury allergy. How's that going to go over? So,
what the part that I don't understand is, and this comes up not just in mercury fillings, but in every single product. It's like when you go to the dentist says, "Oh wait, before I say this, I want to say, you may be wondering where the commercials are." That we're having no commercials today, and it's because of a technical thing. They're repairing the commercial machine.
Hooray.
So we're going to just talk right through. Okay, so what I was going to say is that the thing that seems so odd to me is that in this country, and probably in most industrial countries in the world, there's no information on the product that says there's very, very few, relatively few products that have warnings on the product or even reveal what the ingredients are. So if your dentist says to you, I want to put in a silver filling, that doesn't sound very dangerous. It's the least expensive one. Now, the patient has no reason to know, unless they're listening to the show or reading things I've written or other people have written or what you've written. The patient has no idea that there's anything wrong with those silver fillings. And they go, well, composite is 100 more. I'll go with this silver filling. They have no, because they don't have information, they don't have a choice. And so if instead the dentists were required by law to say, I want to put in a filling. Now, here are your choices. You could have the least expensive one, which has mercury in it, and it's vaporizing mercury in your mouth 24 hours a day. And mercury, by the way, is a toxic substance. And here's some information about the health effects of those toxic substances. And I just had a funny thought. I was just thinking about all those commercials on television for drugs, you know, where they play the beautiful music and people walk through the meadow and they say, and the side effects are death.
The side effects are, if you're listening, the side effects on many of those commercials are just jaw-dropping, and you're going, they're really saying this? Well, they have to, and they don't like it, but they have to tell you that because it's the label. It's on the
because
label.
Because it's a drug. Now, we get to teeth and fillings, and they don't have that requirement. The dentist doesn't have to say, here are the health effects of these mercury fillings. I think if any right-minded person were to have the choices laid out for them, these are the choices of your dental fillings, and they were to see the health effects of mercury, and they were to see that it's only $100 more to not have to be poisoned by mercury and have $100,000 worth of medical bills later on after you've spent 20 years having mercury fillings, then I think that would be a better choice.
Well, there's that issue. There are a number of issues about amalgam. One of them is that I just learned this recently, but apparently the amalgam, the alloy that the mercury is bound to, expands and contracts with cold and heat or whatever. I don't know how much the temperature in the mouth changes, but in any event, these amalgams have been blamed for cracking teeth. So, how much does it cost to repair a cracked tooth? And when the tooth is cracked, what does that do for the life of the tooth? Because obviously, what happens when the tooth has to come out in the end is extremely expensive, because then you're getting an implant, which can cost like $5,000 a piece, I guess the number I've heard. And so, you know, and then that doesn't mention the cost to society, because when they're using the mercury in their offices, then they have to dispose of it. And if they dispose of it properly, that's another expense. So you have all of these downstream costs, and you're going to quibble over $100. Well, it seems suspect. And one of the questions, of course, that has to leap to anybody's mind who's paying attention to this is, what happened at the Department of Health and Human Services, and was there more to it? And I haven't been able to get there yet. I'm going to try. It's not an easy answer to find, but because I will tell you that I did search the lobbying records of all of the American Dental Association's lobbying team, if I'll call them, the outside lobbyists that they hire in Washington, because everybody here has a lobbyist, and they have several, and I went through all the reports during the time frame that this issue came up, because I don't know exactly what year the Department of Health and Human Services rejected this, but I'm assuming that it was a long process and it dragged out. I couldn't find any reference, and that's partly due to the limitations of the lobbying laws, the disclosure laws. If you are a lobbyist, you're a big guy, you know, a former House Majority Leader, or, you know, some senior member of Congress, or, you know, a guy who's a heavyweight lobbyist in D.C., who's got connections, and you saunter over to the Department of Health and Human Services and have a sit down with one of the senior people, and you make your arguments, you get in the door because of who you are. Nothing illegal about this. What's frustrating is that when the lobbyists make their disclosure reports, one, if they only made one meeting, but they were a full-time lobbyist, they only made one, had attended one meeting on this one subject, they technically don't have to disclose it, because there has to be a time threshold that you devoted to a particular subject before you have to disclose. That's number one. And two, you can do it in a vague way. So I don't know whether, but I'd be surprised I'd be really surprised, given the stakes for the dentists who want to. And let me say that what the dentist stakes are for a moment, if I can. The dentists face potential lawsuits. I'm sure that I know that we all sign these releases before procedures in medical offices. Next time I go to my dentist, I'm going to read the one that I sign, if I have to. I probably have a standing one that's in the office there, but how many rights we're giving away in terms of seeking recourse against the dentist if he hurts you. There are ways around that if you got a good trial lawyer, but they're hard to do. So the dentist stakes are they might face lawsuits for past from patients in the past, but they certainly will be on notice that they better not use this stuff unless it's the only way to repair a tooth is with amalgam. And apparently there are certain situations where amalgam is clearly the better option. One of the problems is everybody in the country has a unique health profile. We have a lot going on in our bodies, and when toxins are introduced by ingestion or inhalation, and in this case it's inhalation, when they're introduced, they may or may not be disposed of, excreted by the body. Mm-hmm. And there's a scientist that I wrote about in one of the stories out in Colorado who's doing cutting-edge research. And if he's correct, he's figured out a lot. And he estimates that 20% of the people in the United States who've had mercury amalgams placed in their teeth have some sort of impairment as a result to their health. They're under stress, is the way he would put it. It doesn't. They may not have any symptoms, but they're under stress. And then he estimates that 5 to 10% of those people are seriously ill. That is a staggering statistic, if accurate. And what does he base that on? Well, one, he developed a test to determine. It's called the tri-test, and he tests hair, blood, and urine to determine what, where, and he, well, let me back up a second. He figured out a way to distinguish between inorganic mercury, which is the mercury in your teeth, if you have these fillings, and organic mercury, which is the mercury known as methyl mercury that's in fish. And then he developed this tri-test for hair, urine, and blood. And he's able, he says, to see how much inorganic mercury you have in your blood and your urine. And organic mercury, interestingly, excretes also in your hair. You never find inorganic mercury in your hair. Only the mercury from fish gets in your hair.
That's interesting.
I have no idea why.
He's doing this.
But in any event,
he's
right.
He's so thorough about it.
He's taken blood tests of over 10,000 people. And so his projection of the potential number of Americans who are impaired is based on a pretty large sample. Now, it's hard to know how many of those people came to him because they thought they had a mercury problem, which would skew the results. And I pushed them on that point. They didn't really get an answer. He's not a scientist who is publishing research, so he's not subject to peer review. He's running a company. His name is Chris Shade, S-H-A-D-E, you can find his company is known as Quicksilver Scientific, Quicksilver being another name for mercury. Mm-hmm. It's been used over the decades or centuries, even probably. So you have this issue of possibly pioneering research indicating a way to find out if you are being harmed or if your body's actually processing the mercury okay. And he says probably 80% of the population who have mercury fillings is okay. Now, how big is that population? Well, the U.S. Public Health Service stopped tallying figures, but they actually did up till 2004 on how many Americans have mercury fillings and how many in their teeth, which is pretty amazing. And the last number was 181 million. So what's 5 to 10% of 181 million? Well, that could be up to 18 million people that he says could be seriously ill. Most of them don't know that it's mercury is doing the damage. Mercury being perhaps the most toxic chemical on the planet, the most dangerous, except for maybe plutonium, the non-radiological or radiation toxin. It's potentially, and a lot more research needs to be done, and it's unclear. I haven't explored how much funding the NIH is throwing at this, but a lot more research needs to be done.
It just seems to me, are you familiar with the, I can't think of this word now, the principle about, precautionary principle. The precautionary principle. Do you know that?
I may know it, but I don't know the term.
It's been established as it's called the precautionary principle, and it states that if something is known to be harmful, that one should be cautious about using it. And people apply that as a principle in different sciences.
Common sense.
It's just common sense. And so, it just seems like that throughout the government and manufacturing and everything, that we should be looking at these chemicals. I mean, it's not a question that mercury is toxic. This is not a question. It's not, but what is, I think, so difficult about this, for, regulators to make a decision or a manufacturer to make a decision. I mean, it's easy for me to make a decision about what I'm going to allow in my body. Because I can do the research. I can look at an article like yours and say, mercury fillings cause all these illnesses. I think I'm not going to take a chance. And, but I think that other people who are making decisions for the world at large or a country or something, it's like, they can look at this and they can say, well, here's a population of people who may not be affected at all. And here's a population of people who may be affected somewhat, or, and then there's a smaller amount that are really going to be affected and get really, really, really sick. And instead of giving us information that says, okay, here's mercury fillings, and some of you are not going to be affected, and some are going to get really sick, and we know this, why not give people that information so that there can be a choice? And I, you know, it's like, I think that they're looking at, well, this population over here isn't going to get sick, and so that's what we're going to base it on, instead of looking at the people who are going to get really sick.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I neglected to mention that two FDA outside advisory panels were pushing the agency to do more. When this is somewhat unusual to my way of thinking, given that we've read so much and seen so much about how when the FDA appoints an advisory panel, it seems like, you know, a lot of the folks on the panel they have conflicts of interest, or they either worked for or still work for one of the companies that has a big stake in the in the subject, or they've done research at a university and been funded by that company and so forth. That's probably more likely. I think the very, very direct conflicts of interest are avoided for obvious reasons, but what you find when you dig into it is that there are hidden conflicts of interest that come into play. And, you know, most of us know that the scientific world, you know, it's cutthroat. Researchers are trying to get money from the NIH. They compete with each other, and you really have to be in the 85th, I think, percentile is what it currently is, to get any money. And if you don't get money from the government, what's your option? You're going to have to turn to industry, to come, you know, pharmaceutical industry, the chemical industry, maybe it's the dental products industry that's funding your research. You need to put bread on the table, so you're gonna do that. And some people do it for other reasons. I'm not saying that it's always driven by not being able to get government money, but the point is these panels are typically, you see exposés in the paper about this panel or that panel for the FDA outside panel that's loaded up with people who have hidden conflicts of interest. Yet here you have an FDA advisory panel that votes 15-7. I said 15-6 in my story. It was actually 15-7. That they want the FDA to do more. They don't accept the FDA's write-up white paper on analyzing the health effects of mercury fillings. Here, the FDA is being its research is being spurned by its own outside advisory panel. So the panel in that was in 2006 and in 2010, and so the FDA really got pushed, and the Center for Devices and Radiological Health turns around and actually does something, you know, and then they get shot down by HHS. It's to me startling. I've been here in Washington for 38 years, and I don't remember seeing many developments like this one at the FDA.
It seems to me like the priority is financial, and that we have an FDA who's, as you said at the beginning of the show, that their job is to find out what's safe and what's not safe and protect us. And then they can come up with a decision like this and then have the financial, a different agency, say, well, we can't do this. And so that it all comes down to money. It doesn't come down to health. And I don't see how we can create a healthy world unless health and, you know, the sustaining of the environment and those kinds of things are first. And then we see how to handle the finances.
Well, that would be the ideal, wouldn't it?
It would be a very different world, wouldn't it? that would be the ideal, but that's what I apply in my own life.
You know, when I came to Washington in 1977, Deborah, it was a pretty sleepy town. Now it's a happening place, but there are neighborhood after neighborhood with these multi-million-dollar homes. But you look around for industry. Well, Exxon was here, but headquartered out in the Virginia suburbs, and they're leaving. I think on January 1st of next year, and the biggest industry in town in this area that's boomed to, you know, population of 4 or 5 million people, 6 million. I don't know the current population of the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. I can just tell you that it has been transformed over the last, nearly four decades since I came here. And one of the biggest industries is lobbying. And while lobbyists convey a lot of valuable information, especially if there are two competing sides and both have equal access and they can make the arguments and inform and educate the member of Congress or a regulatory person that they're lobbying, when they have access and the other side doesn't even know what's going on, then the process is very tilted. And so when you talk about toxic chemicals, you really can't, and changing the world, you really can't do so, in my view, without bringing that into the discussion.
The lobbying?
Yeah. I mean, just the influence of the moneyed interests that you're talking about. And that's the manifestation of the money is the lobbying. And these lobbyists get paid so much money and some of them basically are people who just usher somebody else in. All they're paid for is to enable that party to have access. And just one of the things, going back to the FDA, when I came here, the FDA had this pristine reputation as being, you know, the premier regulator of public health and safety with respect to drugs and food products and so forth in the world. And typically when the FDA approved something, that meant it was going to be approved quickly around the world. Now you look and you see that Norway and Sweden and Denmark, I believe, have all banned mercury amalgam.
Yeah.
And there's an international treaty called the Minamata Convention. It's named, by the way, for a public health catastrophe that happened in the 1950s and early 60s in Japan at Minamata Bay. Along the coastline of that bay was a big chemical company, and they dumped mercury along with other chemicals into the water for years and years and years, and the fish were, you know, heavily exposed to the mercury and got loaded up with the mercury, and the fish-eating population surrounding the bay ate the fish. And 1,700 people, more than 1,700 people died. And so they named this treaty to try to get the nations of the world to eliminate mercury from use and to protect people everywhere from this horrible toxin. And the United States was the first country to sign it. The problem is the Minamata, and there, it has prodded some action. The European nations are moving towards the EU now has a recommendation. I was just told yesterday to deal with, I think, phase out amalgam mercury fillings. And the United States, there's no teeth to this treaty. That's the problem with the treaty. It doesn't have a timetable. It just says we agree that we should get rid of mercury. And it's interesting because the president of the United States, Barack Obama, was a very strong advocate of getting rid of mercury when he was during his brief time in the Senate. And I think he spoke about it early in his presidency publicly and said we've got to get mercury away from our children or something like that. But yet his FDA isn't able to do anything because the HHS is in the way.
Well, I think that we need a big overhaul. We need a big overhaul in everything. I mean, I really see what the obstacles are to, like, why we continue to have toxic chemicals. Because, I mean, the obvious question is, if we know it's toxic, why is it still on the market? And I even have so many people have said, well, they wouldn't sell it if it was toxic. And I even, there was just an article in a New York paper, I think the New York Post or something, where a woman was saying, oh, these people who are talking about toxics, they don't know anything. We have government agencies that are protecting us. It would not be on the shelf if it wasn't safe for us to use. She actually said this was just printed in a New York paper a month ago. This is still like a prevalent idea. And yet it's just not true. It's just not true.
Speaking of outspoken women, one of those who I interviewed is a remarkable lady named Freya Koss. Mm-hmm. She lives in a suburb west of Philadelphia, and she is the one who had a mercury filling put in, if I recall, by a doctor in New York. Who used an old formula where he actually mixed up. Now they come sort of pre-mixed, but they call it, the dental industry likes to say they're encapsulated, that the mercury's encapsulated, which is debatable, at least debatable. Yeah. And she had this dentist use liquid mercury where he actually mixed it in with a little powder of other metals before he put it in her mouth. And 7 days later, her big hobby in her life was going to the ballet and taking ballet lessons. She was at the ballet, a ballet performance at the University of Pennsylvania. She felt a little dizzy. She walked out to her car, climbed in her car, and suddenly she saw multiple images of everything. And she sat there stunned, not knowing what was happening to her. And finally, she figured out that if she closed one eye, she could see. So she drove herself home. Well, this began a sort of an odyssey for her over the next year, over the next days at the beginning, where she went on the internet determined to find out what was happening to her, because doctors were almost immediately diagnosing her with either lupus or multiple sclerosis. And ultimately, she found, she said at 3:20 in the morning on the fifth day, as she was scouring the internet, she finds a posting by a woman in England who had written that she got had a mercury filling placed and implanted in one of her teeth, and a few days later she got double vision, and she sat there, her jaw dropped, said, "Oh my God. It might have been my mercury filling that caused this problem."
Yeah.
And then she connected with mercury-free groups, groups of former mercury patients who were campaigning, joining with the consumer lawyers and trying to get mercury out of dentistry. And had hers taken out. And what do you know? Her multiple sclerosis went away. She's 73 years old now.
Yeah.
But one of the things that she did along the way, which reflects her determination to do something about this, is to persuade the Philadelphia City Council to pass an ordinance requiring informed consent for all dental patients in the city, so that any patient who goes into a dental office in Philadelphia is told about the risks of mercury fillings.
That is so wonderful. And see, listeners, we can all do things like that. When we have this information, we can do things to make other people know about them and give other people choices so that we're not just walking around inadvertently, unknowingly, being poisoned and having experiences like this. And we, just because the government is not protecting us from these toxic chemicals doesn't mean that we shouldn't be protecting ourselves. And the information is there and we can make those decisions ourselves. We only have just a couple of minutes left. We've been talking for almost an hour.
Yeah, lots I've been talking
say.
A lot.
And yes, you have a lot of interesting things to say. So do you want to just give us some final thoughts for a couple minutes?
Well, my big thought is that I hope to do more on this, but I'm also right now covering the Clinton emails and writing a story about the 10th anniversary of the devastation of Hurricane Katrina for a 48-page package that our paper down in Biloxi, Mississippi is putting out. But I hope to do more, so I hope that your listeners will plug into McClatchyDC.com and type in my name and look for Mercury stories about mercury fillings. I think there's a lot more to be done here because without trying to take sides, I just think it's really interesting what evolved during this rulemaking process, and it sort of leaps out as a strong possibility that there was some sort of influence that was wielded to persuade the Department of Health and Human Services to do what they did. It may have been a totally pure process of cost-benefit analysis and a hard decision to protect the poor, but that seems it sort of seems unlikely to me.
It seems unlikely to me as well. I mean, there could be things that, first of all, I think a lot of people who are poor, unless I'm mistaken, are now being covered by Obamacare. And so that would be covered by insurance. And also, people
Doesn't
can learn
Obamacare
to take care of...
Doesn't Obamacare include dental insurance?
Yes.
Oh, it does. Okay. I did not know that.
Yes. In fact, I have some Obamacare insurance myself. And
you have it.
And I have dental care.
That's terrific.
Anyway, yeah, I'm waiting until I use up my huge deductible, and then they'll pay for my dental work. But that's another story. And anyway, so I think there are things that could be done to help the poor not be poisoned, because all they can afford is mercury fillings. So anyway, thank you so much. This has been so interesting for me. And please let me know when you have another article about mercury fillings or any other toxic chemicals.
I will endeavor to do that.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to be on your show. Thanks very much.
Thanks. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Jeff Berlin-Gadd, and you can find out more at ToxicFreeTalkRadio.com. Be well.